8:15 having arrived, I'm going to call the Education Finance Committee to order. And we don't have a quorum yet, so we're not going to move the bill. But our first bill up is House File 818. Representative Moran, when we have a quorum, I'll let you move that bill. But otherwise, if you would begin presenting your bill. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair and members. And thank you again, once again, for allowing this bill to be heard in our committee. And so we have had a lot of good conversation around closing the achievement gap, the need for early childhood, the need for early childhood education. We've talked about brain development. We have had extensive conversation about research-based, evidence-based, looking at outcomes. And so we know that there's two factors that we've been looking at, and that is parents and teachers. It's good to have a effective teacher in front of the classroom, and it's also good to have parents engaged in the process of educating their children. But also, an additional part of that is having a strong school means having a strong principal that goes beyond just the caretaking of the building, who is connected to the teachers, who's also connected to children. And so I think, and we think, that the Principal Academy, the Minnesota Principal Academy, is a good investment in improving outcomes for our children, having effective teachers in front of the classroom, and having great schools. And so to talk a little bit more about the Principal Academy, I would like to defer to my first testifier.
Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. And before we begin, we do have a quorum now. So Representative Moran does move her bill to be laid over for possible inclusion into the omnibus bill. And it's an honor to have you here, Chair Segrin, or Commissioner Segrin. I've been telling stories, but my first, I was mentioning my first term I was on with Chair Maris. And he was the policy chair, and he had had me come up and chair like about the third meeting. He went down and he asked me to chair the meeting at that time. But Chair Segrin, my second term in, I was the Democrat on the conference committee that you helped get me on there. So I never forgot that. Appreciate that. So it's an honor to have you here, and thank you.
Thank you, members, and it is a wonderful honor to be here. My name is Alice Segrin, and I am here today just to give you a brief overview of the history of the Minnesota Principals Academy, and then we're going to actually have one of our principals in Minnesota that has gone through the program to share his experiences with you. Back in 2005, former Senator Steve Kelly came to me when I was commissioner and said, Alice, I think that we really need to think about the professional development of our principals beyond their initial training. Because as Representative Moran said, it's very, very important. Research has shown that 25% of student learning effect is caused by a good principal in the building, or lack thereof, if you will. And then 33% of student learning is caused by the teacher. So we have focused a lot, as Representative Moran said, on teachers and parents and the importance of them. But the principal was sort of left behind, if you will. And so I thought it was a wonderful idea. I said, yes, I think we should create an appropriation and do something about this. So we did. We worked together in a bipartisan way, and we formed the Minnesota Principal Academy. We actually did a national search and looked all over the country at different leadership programs. And we discovered the National Institute for School Leadership that provides the curriculum and the framework around this program. You have a handout that should be at your desk at this point. I think the pages will be handing that out. And it talks about the units that are covered. This program was developed with $11 million of research and development funded by the Carnegie, Broad, Stupski, and New Ventures School Fund. So it had extremely a lot of work behind it. The development was done by the National Council for the Education and the Economy. This is a nonprofit organization that has a lot to do with standards development and good best practice. What they did was draw upon the best educational minds in the country, the best business leaders, and also they used military. And people go, military? What they did was use, and they used the best kind of simulation models that the military uses as they look at and analyze best practice. So they may throw the principles into a situation, a simulation, and how you would react to that sort of thing. The program consists of 13 units. Those units are spread over about 18 to 24 months, depending on how the cohorts, when the cohorts meet. The principal is out of their building 2 days a month, and they come together as a cohort to really dig into what it means to be an instructional leader, to understand standards-based instruction, and how to implement change over time. First thing that they look at is the educational challenge. They move into, and it's infused, the whole program is infused with what is good standards-based instruction. But they start off right away looking at, do I believe that every child can learn? What are the educational challenges with immigrant populations, with children that come with many, many different needs, special education, if they come with undernourished or issues with their families, so many things. What are the educational challenges that we're looking at? And then how do we work as a leader to solve those issues? It's data-driven, so they bring the data about their schools, and then they right away start looking at an action learning project and trying to figure out what they're going to do to actually change the work that is going on in their school according to the data that is driving that action learning. This program is the best kind of professional development because it is job embedded, it is cohort based, and it's the practice of what you're learning. You're continually implementing what you're learning. There's too much drive-by professional development where you come and you have maybe the book of the year, the book of the month club type of a speaker that has got a new best practice. But most of the time we don't systematically and systemically embed what we're learning into our schools and in our classrooms. So it's an extraordinary program. We have, and we went to a statewide implementation back in 2005. The NISL program actually certifies facilitators, and they have a very rigorous process. That's how they keep the fidelity to the program. We have 48 certified NISL trainers. They're Minnesota people that came from the principal's rank, the superintendent's rank. There were people that came out of the Department of Education and out of the University of Minnesota. So that makes up our cadre of certified trainers. We have two facilitators that go through the whole program together with the principals, and then we have those 48 various people that have expertise in, say, math or science or whatever, coming in when appropriate to facilitate each of the different units. The other thing that really convinced us that this was a good program is what Representative Moran, Chair Marquardt has been looking at. Do we have evidence that this is really best practice? Do we have evaluation that says that this really impacts student achievement? And yes, this program does. That's the question that the principals' associations, the superintendents' association, and we asked. And this is a program that's been in place for probably over 10 years. Massachusetts and Pennsylvania were two states that have implemented it the longest and the most robustly. And Johns Hopkins and Old Dominion universities actually did independent, separate evaluations on both of their states' programs. This is in your packet of information. Statistically significant impact on student achievement, and these were looking at diverse populations of students. And you don't get that kind of student effect normally in many, many programs that are implemented. This program, both universities were blown away, literally, by the results of this program. Large student achievement gains, particularly in high school, which is very, very unusual. And the student effect was extraordinary. So that also convinced us that we really had a good program at our hands because it had been researched, developed very robustly, and had independent evaluation that said, yes, this program does make a difference. So I'm going to now be really quiet, and I'm going to let our next guest share his experience as a principal.
Thank you so much. Please identify yourself.
My name is Joey Page. I'm president-elect of the Minnesota Elementary School Principals Association, and I'm also the principal of a K-5 school in Richfield called the Richfield STEM School. I've been a participant in the Principals Academy. I was part of the second cohort that went through, and I can tell you my experience from that point and as a practicing principal was ever changed on how I approach my job, how I can work with colleagues, how I use information to move my school to higher levels of achievement. And it's not to say that my administrative degree wasn't preparation or a doctoral program, but as you get into the role of an acting principal, and as Commissioner Segrin had said, there is not a lot of opportunities for ongoing professional development for principals. Schools are very complex, they're ever-changing, the needs are very demanding, and to have a program such as the Principals Academy in place and for principals to come back in and to talk about the issues, to look at research, to do some of these practical experiences from your school and have others help you through that thinking or through the implementation and evaluation was just extraordinary. It's been a legislative priority, I know, for the Elementary Principals Association for a number of years, and I feel very fortunate that we've had hundreds of principals in the state that have gone through that, and hope that that can continue and that others have the opportunity. It's nice to see also that it's ever expanding, too, because when I went through it, they've added some more curriculum areas in as far as working with science, special ed unit now, and I think we want to do some things around Minnesota too where we talk about early childhood education, community education, and look at all of the different stakeholders and partners that are important for our schools to be successful.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Welcome.
Good morning. My name is Ken Dragseth. I'm Director of Administrative Licensure at the University of Minnesota and a former superintendent before I retired. I'm going to talk to you just a little bit about the university's connection and a little bit about the budget. Back in the 80s and 90s, the Bush Foundation collaborated with the Carlson School of Management to provide what we called at that time, it was the Bush Principals Executive Development Program, and it was the Executive Development Program for district office people. At that time, hundreds of administrators in the state of Minnesota were able to participate in a very high quality executive development program. I was fortunate because the two roles I was in to actually be one of the few that was in both, maybe I need a lot of training or what, I'm not sure, but it was a great experience. And what we found out of that was some things that Principal Page talks about is that the idea of a cohort, the idea of once you've been in the position for a while to sit back and do executive development. It's not much different than you do in the corporate world all the time, taking your good people and making them better by doing development programs. So when I came to the university, and we were real, you know, the Principals Academy has been there in the College of School Readiness, I was asked last summer to lead a study to look at the program again after it's been involved now for 7 years. And so we gathered people from the university, research evaluators, the organizational leader had some principals. We did a survey of all the people who have been through the program. We looked at many national programs again to see, like good stewards of programs, if this is still the best. And we came to the conclusion that NISL, again, is still the best program for principal executive development in the country. But we also found out that things are changing in Minnesota, and there's a lot of different things that need to be included. And so we are going to expand the program from the 26 days to 30 days. It will, the areas that were asked to be addressed are the community engagement piece. The principals are asked to work with families of color, immigrants, with social agencies, police departments, on. And they felt they needed some discussion about that. Likewise, the ELL population has expanded all over the state, and principals will look for experience in that. You also have the principal and teacher evaluation. We keep hearing from teachers and from principals that this is a very crucial effort, but it's got to be done well, so how can we help make that work? And then the whole area of diversity, cultural competency around the states. We're going to add some of those, but we're in doing that, two things that I'm very proud of the university in doing, and in that we have included, and in this case, four departments in this effort. The College of Education and Human Development, obviously, but also the Center for Integrative Leadership with former Senator Kelly as a part of that. He is going to lead with his group the Hugh area of community engagement. We're also going to work with the Humphrey Institute and the Carlson School of Management to provide leadership, special lecturers on special topics of leadership and so on. So as a K-12 person coming into the university, to me it did not make sense to have the silos that were there. And so the whole effort was to try to break those down and get cross-departmental support, and they do that. The second part of the university's involvement was to this is a highly intense program, and so we asked the university to have some skin in the game also in terms of some credit waiver. And so we proposed, and the university approved, a 12-credit waiver toward a doctoral degree for anybody who's been successfully through the Principal's Academy and is in the doctoral program. Now, that is about $12,000 to $15,000 to the individual who would go in that program in savings, but it's also about a year of their time. And so we think that that match will work well. We are intending to start run two cohorts per year. The first one will be a metropolitan expanded cohort. The second one, we intend to go in the northwest part of the state, which has not been. We've trained about 300 principals so far out of the 1,500 in the state. We would like to get about 800 trained. We'll go in the northwest. We've got a request from the southwest part of the state, which we intend to do one. We've got one from the south part. The demand is there. The principals want this program and are wondering when can we bring it forward. So we're intending to do that. As regards to the budget, the program over a two-year period costs about $900,000, mainly to provide the facilitators are in the program. You have a copy of the budget in your documents, and I won't go over it by detail. But basically, for the core curriculum program, a few minor kind of food location, that kind of thing. We also have someone who will direct the program, and we'll make that effort low-priced budget process. So we've done everything we can to reduce the price so that it's competitive. We're asking, again, about half of that from the legislature, $450,000 over the biennium. We do believe that, as it was in the Bush Foundation program, that skin in the game by the district is important. And so we're asking that the district or the individual come up to $3,500 for the program over the two-year period. We will try to do some funding from outside resources and foundations, and we're working on that. So we'll hope to reduce that. But as we found, we want the connection between the school board, the superintendent, the principal, and that building to occur. And part of that is an ongoing ending of the program project, where they all work together to improve the achievement in the building. So we think it's an outstanding program. I've said all along that if you can't have any one of you know a great school in your district, it has a great principal. And schools that are in trouble, in many cases, leadership is not as strong as it ought to be. And so as a superintendent principal, as someone who has kids in Minnesota and grandkids in Minnesota, I want great principals in our buildings for everybody in Minnesota, and that's the intent of the program. So thank you. And now I would like to have Gary Amoroso, who is Executive Director of Minnesota Association of School Administrators, and Don Johnson, the Interim Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Secondary Principals, talk a little bit about the organizational support.
And Representative Moran, how many more testifiers do you have?
That's it.
Okay, so
there'll
very
a
good.
Comments and you'll be done.
Very good. Thank you much. Please proceed.
Good morning. My name is Don Johnson. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Secondary Principals Association. And you've all heard the phrase, you don't know what you don't know. And that's actually the case for principals as well. a new principal oftentimes find themselves in a new position, and they, to some degree, feel that they have the education and training they need to be effective. But you find out in your first few months and your first couple of years of being a principal that there's some questions you don't have the answers to. And the purpose of the Minnesota Principals Academy is to provide the opportunity to answer those questions. Minnesota Association of Secondary Principals has 1,100 active members, and we are supportive of this effort. We've had over 100 of our own members involved in this process. They come back with the kind of experience that we know is necessary to close the achievement gap, and we know that's important for the state of Minnesota. So we simply offer our support, and we think it's worth our time and effort.
Thank you very much.
Gary Amoroso, Executive Director of Minnesota Association of School Administrators. I want to thank Representative Moran and the other authors for bringing this bill forward. This committee has talked a lot about having decisions based on data, and Commissioner Segrin spoke about the data that shows that the Principals Academy, the program that will be implemented, is one that has been vetted and that has produced results. And that's something that we believe is very important. As all of you know, we have the new principal evaluation law that takes effect July 1st of 2013. And this would be another tool for individuals and districts to use to help promote the growth and development of their principals. And we think it's an important opportunity that would be available to our principals. As former superintendent of our friends in Edina said, you've got an opportunity, Dr. Drag said, you have an opportunity here for the individual to make a commitment. You've got an opportunity for the district to make the commitment, and an opportunity for the state to make the commitment. That is a collaborative effort that I think would be well worth the investment by this committee and by the state. It's job-invented professional development. It's hands-on professional development. It truly provides an opportunity for the individual to grow. And I think we all know that the teacher is probably the most important factor in the achievement level of a student. But research also shows that the principal has an extremely high level of involvement in the growth of children. So we're hoping that this committee and the legislature sees fit to provide funding for the program. MASA fully supports this and endorses this. We've been involved in the development of the program with Dr. Dragseth and his committee, and would hope that you seriously consider supporting. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Reiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this question could maybe for any of you, but it might be for, I have trouble addressing Ms. Segrin without saying commissioner or representative or chair or some title. So I apologize, Alice, for whatever might be the appropriate.
Alice will be just fine.
All right. Thank you. So I strongly support this program, and I've followed it since its inception, and I know it's outstanding. But some of the concerns I have about it relate to some of the issues that were raised by the testifiers about the need. The need is so great, and our capacity to reach out and develop principals in a way that will address some of the demands we're placing on them through such efforts as principal evaluation and teacher evaluation. And I'm wondering what else we need to do. Is this enough? And so I'm going to ask you a few questions about connections. And I'm not saying in any way my support for this program is held hostage to whether you can, you know, whether we can address these or not. But I want to ask you these because you're here in front of us today. One is, what is the interface between the academy and the Board of School Administrators? So, and I'm thinking of such issues as licensure renewal and whether, you know, professional development opportunities, whether there should be a linkage there. That's the first part. And then the second part is, what are the connections, or are there connections between the academy and other post-secondary institutions besides the University of Minnesota that are intimately involved in training our principals? And are we sharing best practices?
Commissioner Segrin.
Thank you. Well, I will let Dr. Dragseth talk about the licensure process, because actually Dr. Dragseth is the director of the licensure program for the University of Minnesota for administrators. And then in regard to and the connection with BOSAR, the Board of School Administrators. when we first began the process, we certainly had the representatives, executive directors from the from the Principals Association and the Superintendents Associations, which represent the the impact of the principals, and the superintendents have to be involved in giving permission for principals to go to this program, and the principals were very key to the approval of this. So also when Dr. Mack was the administrator for the BOSA, he was also engaged and involved in the, hope everyone's okay over there. I think that there has been much input from the people that are directly impacted by this program, and there's strong support for the program from those administrators. I'll have Dr. Dregseth answer the administrative part. In regard to including other MINSCU, let's say, or some of the colleges that also are engaged in, or even some of our private schools, we would welcome the the engagement and support of them. If they wanted to do what the university, that would give the university probably a little competition as far as giving credit towards the NISL program. The NISL program is so comprehensive and covers so, really is the total package of developing the next level of principal leadership, that the things that it covers are just extraordinary. And our principal probably that's gone through the program could maybe even answer some of those specific questions if you have those. But I'll let Dr. Dregseth.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt and members. With the relationship with BOSA, they have been involved in the discussions about the program. Obviously, it's a district office certification at BOSA, as you know, with working with the principals' organizations. I think the bigger question I think you're saying is, how are we connecting? Is the university operating totally independently, or are they connecting with other organizations that are improving principals in the state of Minnesota? Through BOSA, that is our connection. We meet regularly, and we talk about programs all over the state and support the programs all over the state. And there are some great principal licensure programs all over the state in many different institutions and serving it. And we work closely with them and match the competencies that the state has required. We have many of our facilitators come from all over Minnesota, and they've been trained in many different universities. They haven't all been trained at the university by any means. They're facilitators coming from many different programs. So we welcome that, and we welcome guest speakers and critics that be in the program. That'd be great. Thank you.
Representative Myra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Moran, I want to thank you for bringing this bill forward. I'm supportive of the academy. I'm not sure which testifier mentioned that there were 1,500 principals in the state and 300 have been trained, and I think I might have heard that 800 trained principals is the goal, and I was wondering if that could be elaborated. The goal is in the next 5 years, the next 2 years. Could you expand on that, please?
Well, the rapidity in which we can train principals will depend on appropriation. The appropriation that we're asking for the biennium will train about 120 principals for this biennium. We could certainly ramp it up. We have 48 certified trainers if we had more money. But you can, at 30 people a cohort, you also want to make sure that you're having good facilitators and making sure that you're running those appropriately. So you can figure we've got 300. It might take about 5 more years to probably get to the 800 if we're doing, longer than that, if we're doing 100 every 2 years. So depending on the appropriation, we could do more. But when Dr. Dregseth and the university were figuring out a budget, they also wanted to be realistic. We didn't know what kind of forecast we were going to have. So we really have been very fiscally prudent on the request. There's going to be skin on the game. We're going to go out actively and look at foundation support. We're going to help, any rural community that might not have all the money to spend for a, maybe can't meet the $3,500. So we're doing some multiple things to try to be as frugally responsible as possible moving it forward. certainly we would welcome a larger appropriation, and we could do more and do it more quickly. But we feel in the 800 number, we figure that there are a number of principals that already probably have an upper level degree beyond their master's after they became principals. Some already have their doctorate. We have some maybe that have gone into other kinds of intensive programs, and this may not be their fit. But we figured if we had an 800 out of 1,500, that's probably going to provide a really critical mass of academic impact on the state of Minnesota. Would be ideal if everybody did it, of course, but realistically, and some people leave the field and move out of the state. So we thought if we got, you know, that kind of number, that we would really start to see some significant impact on student achievement and the process of improvement in our schools.
Mr.
Representative
Chair.
Myra.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner, could you expand on how principals are selected for this opportunity?
The principals can self-select, Representative Myra. Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, it's been a while. I apologize, Mr. Chair and Representative Myra. They can self-select. The superintendent can choose to send principals through. For an example, Anoka Hennepin, on their own, has decided to send all of their elementary and high school principals through the program because they believed so firmly in this program and the impact that it's had is having on student achievement. So you can do it either way. It's acceptable both ways. Also, assistant principals can ask to be in the program, and we've even had superintendents that have come up to us at various presentations and say, could I go through the program? And yes, they can. Other states actually sometimes will send cohorts of a superintendent, assistant superintendents, and principals through as a team. So it can be done many ways.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sure you know that I'm a supporter of this. I was one of the original co-sponsors, along with former Representative Mark Biskins, who was a principal at the time. But there's a sense of urgency here as we begin to pilot teacher evaluation. And as I look at the 13 units of transforming leadership, Dr. Dragseth, could you comment on to what extent these units will play into a principal's evaluation of a teacher? I'm very impressed that you have added the excellence in literacy, math, science, and so on. But in what other areas will we see an increase in the ability of a principal to evaluate teachers in a fair way and according to the legislation that we've set down?
Dr. Dragsa.
Chair Marquardt, Representative Erickson. Good question. Within the units themselves, one of the concerns that teachers have that we've talked to about the evaluation system is, do, you know, does the principal coming in my classroom have a deeper understanding of the instruction in that's going on in that classroom? In other words, and so in the program, there's a strong, well, science, math, reading are heavily emphasized and taught, and what are the appropriate instructional methods, what are the appropriate curriculum and alignment that's there within the classroom. We spent a lot of time on that and a lot of simulations related to that and so on. In addition to that, we heard strongly, as I said earlier, that they want more on that. So we're bringing in people that will work with them in how do you become effective evaluators of instruction in a classroom, and bringing some experts in to talk about that from various groups and provide them support with that. One of the honors I had, I was co-chair of the Principals Evaluation Work Group that brought that forward last year and saw what principals needed to be evaluated on and how that worked, and have done a lot of work in teacher evaluation, and it's absolutely essential that the principals be trained, and they be trained on what is good instruction and good teaching. And rightfully so, if I'm a teacher in a classroom, I'm going to be concerned about who's making decisions about my career, and we want to hopefully increase that knowledge and ability for them.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Is there, yes,
Mr.
Commissioner.
Chair, if it would be okay, I'd like to also respond to Representative Erickson.
Go ahead.
Representative Erickson, too, the whole program is infused with what is good standards-based instruction. So, you know, even if you are evaluating a social studies teacher, this principal is going to be much more equipped to look at just identifying what's good standards-based instruction. the program pulls the best examples from all over the country of good classroom examples of good standards-based instruction. And so now that we're moving into the principal evaluation and the work and this teacher evaluation, this is going to provide much more comfort, I think, to teachers to know that principals have been trained well in how to evaluate and how to recognize good instruction. It's going to be a much fairer process after going through this, and your principal here probably could even comment on that because he's probably had that experience already. But it's just a very timely program.
Thank you. Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify for or against House File 818? Seeing none, Representative Moran, do you want to have your closing comments?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I know that we face some challenging moments in trying to figure out how we're going to really come up with a great budget for the great needs. But as we look at effective teachers being in front of the classroom, as we look at engaging parents and closing the achievement gap, that we have to have a holistic approach, and that includes having an effective principal at the top leading a great school, a great body of teachers, and working to close the achievement gap. So I hope that we can include this in our budget and create some good results. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Moran renews her motion to lay over House File 818 for possible inclusion. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Chair Marker, from the committee.
Representative Bernardi, House File 448. And while we're doing that, we have time for minutes. Anyone care to move the minutes? Representative McDonald moves to approve the March 19, 2013 minutes. Any discussion on that? If not, I'm going to call for the vote on the minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Those minutes are approved. Thank you. Representative Bernardi, would you like to move your bill?
One of my testifiers. Yes, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 448 for possible inclusion in the Finance Omnibus Bill.
Very good. Please proceed.
Okay, we're getting our testifiers here lined up. Okay, well, thank you very much, members and Chair Marcourt, for the opportunity to come before you today with this important bill. As I usually lead out with the bills that I introduce, is that support student performance. It provides funding adequacy, or it helps lead to that. And also it's funding equity because one of the ways to look at it is each of our school lunches in all of our schools would get the money to help support nutritious school lunches. I think a lot of us have common understanding here that there's a lot of studies out there that show that nutrition helps support student achievement. And I think a lot of people are also aware about the childhood obesity epidemic. It's becoming, we're starting to change some of the trends, but it's still very troublesome. This is the first generation in America's history in which our children have a shorter life expectancy than we do as parents. And that's very troublesome. Our bill today is just one tool in the toolbox to help address this. We need better access to healthy foods for our children, both at school and at home. We do have new and improved federal standards that's helping bring more fruits, fresh vegetables, and whole grains to our schools. And we know as parents this is the right thing to do. This bill has bipartisan support, which I'm pleased to report. Our legislative work group of our colleagues, who it's led by Representative Norton and Representative Detmer, have also supported this bill. Minnesota Healthy Kids Coalition, who's working to reduce or end childhood obesity, has 30 organizations that are working to implement state and federal policies to address childhood obesity epidemic. And then, of course, our Minnesota School Nutrition Association really knows this is important for our children. With us today, we have testifiers who I would like to introduce, and of course, I probably don't have it right in front of me. So they're going to have to introduce themselves, but I do want to point out Amy Kimmel is from my school district, and we I'm pleased that she is here today at the school district in which I graduated from, so I'm glad that she had the opportunity to come today. And then we have a representative from Owatonna, and then a mother, and Michelle and Grace Johnson, who are from the Hopkins School District, so we're pleased to have them here today. Thank you.
So, Representative Bernardi, how many total witnesses do you have?
Four.
Okay, so I'm just going to ask the witnesses to stay very precise, if you could. All right, thank you very much. And who's going to start?
I'm going to start first, please.
Please proceed.
All right, introduce well, thank yourself. You, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Rachel Valiseno, and I am the public policy chair for the Minnesota School Nutrition Association and then also the nutrition director for Owatonna Public Schools. So I do thank you for the opportunity to be here this morning to testify on behalf of the Minnesota School Nutrition Association in support of House File number 448. I know that we've all been hearing a lot about these new nutrition standards that schools across the country have had to implement as of this fall. And I wanted to start by just saying that, first and foremost, these new nutrition standards for school meals are great news for the kids in our state and across the country. And they're going to help school nutrition professionals build on the work that we're already doing to provide more fruits and vegetables, whole grains, and healthier entrees in our school cafeterias. And I just wanted to take a moment to quickly review what those new nutrition standards specifically are providing to our kids in our state and across the country. As already mentioned, of course, they are providing more fruits and vegetables, including weekly servings now of dark green vegetables, red orange vegetables, starchy vegetables, and legumes. And so that's something that is, you know, quite a change in comparison to previous years. Also, the new standards require more whole grains, fat-free or 1% milk, and then age-appropriate limits on calories, sodium, and saturated fats. Along with these changes, students now also must have a fruit or vegetable as a part of their lunch each day in order for it to be considered complete. And it's well known that Americans do not come close to consuming, of course, the recommended number of servings of fruits and vegetables each day. So this definitely is a step in the right direction as we work to help our students create healthy habits that are going to last a lifetime. Many districts offer multiple choices of fruits and vegetables each day on their menus. And this, of course, then helps to guarantee that every student that comes through that lunch line is going to easily be able to identify with a fruit or vegetable that they're familiar with or that they know that they love. And they're going to be able to quickly, you know, find something that they are going to have for lunch that day. And furthermore, they also are going to be exposed to new fruits and vegetables, and they're going to have a chance to, of course, try a new food. And so that's always exciting for them to, you know, take on something, a new food that they enjoy. Well, we also know how important, of course, it is to encourage the students to accept and consume all of these healthier options. And school nutrition professionals across our state have found great ways to get students excited about these healthy food choices and are continuing constantly to be, you know, working on creative solutions to ensure that healthy foods appeal to our students. Wanted to just share a few examples of some of the great things that are currently happening across our state. I'm sure many of you are familiar with the Farm to School movement. We've got several districts participating in Farm to School programs that, of course, are bringing fresh local produce, grains, and even, you know, beef and chicken into our school cafeterias. And not only are, of course, they, you know, this helping our economy, you know, obviously we can't get any fresher than foods, you know, right, you know, from down the road, but it's also helping students to know where their food comes from. There's a huge disconnect, I think we all know, in our country as far as how does our food get from the farm to our plate. And so there's just so many benefits of farm-to-school programs. There's also many districts that host student taste tests on a regular basis to get feedback directly from the students themselves and to get them involved in the menu planning process. We know that definitely the more involvement that we have, you know, with our students in the menu planning process, the more likely they are going to be to, of course, enjoy the items that end up on our menus. Some districts are doing what is known as a Harvest of the Month program that will introduce students to a new fruit or vegetable every month. And so, again, that's one day every month the kids can get excited about and look forward and you know, find something new in their cafeterias that they've never tried before. Many districts involve students and parents to gather recipe suggestions to reflect ethnic and regional favorite foods into their menus. And then also, we've got several districts in our state that are offering unlimited fresh fruits and vegetables to students so that they can truly, you know, fill up on any given day with an abundance of fruits and vegetables. And then in addition, of course, when there's unlimited fruits and vegetables, they can, again, feel free and comfortable to sample something new that they have never had before. I also just wanted to share a little bit about...
Ms. Valenzano, could you... Please wrap up, please.
Sure.
We've got a number of testifiers.
Well, let me just quickly refer to the handout, one of the handouts that we provided for you. It's this colorful handout here. wanted to just have you note the change from the lunch tray on the left to the lunch tray on the right. That's the lunch tray from last year in comparison to this year. Also in front of us, we've got a lunch tray last year compared to this year. To give you a real good example of how much now, how many more fruits and vegetables we have to offer this year in comparison to, yeah, see those black beans, those legumes. And, you know, this alone truly is you know, kind of what's affecting us financially is that increase in the fruits and vegetables that we're being required to provide, you know, which is why, of course, we are seeking an increase in state meal reimbursement of 2 cents for every school lunch that we are serving. And so, you know, definitely, you know, you can see the example on the bottom of that sheet that talks about how one district in Minnesota, you can see how dramatically their produce costs have increased in just a matter of 4 years. So definitely, you know, we feel that, you know, the financial support that we receive through state reimbursements, you know, through student payments, it's definitely not enough to help cover the costs that actually go into producing one of these beautiful school lunches. And so we definitely need additional financial support to help our local programs remain financially viable. And so we definitely, you know, would just urge you to please support an increase in our school nutrition funding by 2 cents for every school lunch. So I thank you for the time, and I will turn it over to Ms. Kimmel.
Ms. Kimmel, please proceed.
The choice is clear.
Very good.
Seal of approval.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Amy Kimmel, and I'm the Nutrition Services Coordinator with the Spring Lake Park School District. My colleagues and I work hard to provide meals to Minnesota school children that are nutritious, low in cost, and appealing to the students. At times, this can be a difficult balancing act. The vast majority of school districts cannot cover the cost of a school lunch through the traditional combination of student payments, federal funding, and state funding. According to the Minnesota Department of Education last year, schools in Minnesota lost an average of 35 cents for every lunch that we served, and that was before the new lunch requirements were implemented. Most schools have been making up that 35 cent gap between the cost of producing a school lunch and the revenues received by selling individual food items in the a la carte lines. Unfortunately, for our students and for our budgets, newly proposed federal regulations are expected to severely limit the foods that we can sell in our a la carte lines. So you ask, well, why don't we just raise our lunch prices? And the answer is, well, we do raise lunch prices regularly. However, we're cautious about raising the prices too much or too often. We know that when the price of a school lunch goes up, it creates a hardship for many of our families, especially those who just missed the financial requirement to qualify for reduced price meals. These families struggle to pay full price. When we raise prices, some of them stop participating. When participation drops, it is bad for the children who now lose their access to healthy, nutritious meals, and schools lose their economy of scale. So overall, additional state funding for school lunch can help us to keep lunch prices affordable for families, to reduce our dependence on a la carte sales to make ends meet, and to help us cover the cost of providing more nutritious but more costly items like the important fresh fruits, vegetables, and whole grains. We would appreciate your support. Our kids and families would also appreciate your support. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And good morning and welcome to the committee. If you would introduce yourself.
My name is Michelle Johnson. I live in Minnetonka. I am a mom of Grace, who is in fifth grade, and Peter, who is in third grade. I'm also a teacher in the Hopkins School District. It's a privilege to speak to you today about our experiences with our school lunches in Hopkins. I often make comparisons to the 70s, 80s, and 90s and the lunches that we were served, which were similar to the TV dinners that maybe some of you remember, which are pretty gross. And the lunches we have at our school are amazing. Some of the differences today, and what I love to see is that our chef, Kathy, will often show the kids, you know, here's a butternut squash, and here's what it looks like inside, and she'll show the children and educate them as they come through the line. And then the children are much more apt to try new things. Our family changed the way we eat a couple of years ago, trying to eliminate as much of the processed carbs and foods that are often available to us, and focus really on fruits and vegetables and high foods that are high in protein. As a mom, this meal here is so encouraging to know that my kids are going to be able to have this available to them. And when my kids go to school, the school supports exactly what we're doing at home, and I know that when they go to school to eat, they are getting exactly what their bodies need. Each day our school serves tons of veggies, and everything there is just hand cut, freshly made. It's beautiful. Often I will take pictures of the meals and post them to Facebook because I'm super proud of the way our school is feeding our kids. My personal favorite lunch is a spinach salad that some fifth grade girls really encouraged me to try when I was there teaching one day. And I mean, it has onions and cranberries and walnuts, and I mean, just super, super healthy. So I just love that my kids have that available to them. I believe that we are what we eat and that our performance is directly affected by that. My kids, the afternoon rigor that they face is high, and to know that they're not stuffing their bodies full of starchy foods and foods high in carbs, that they're going to be able to sustain what they need and their strength and energy for the rest of the day. So as a mom, I fully support the 2-cent funding increase for a healthy food initiative to continue in our schools. Thank you for letting me speak. And now my daughter has a few words.
Please proceed.
Hi, I'm Grace Johnson. I go to Glen Lake Elementary in the Hopkins School District, and I play hockey and soccer. Thanks for letting me speak today, and I would like to speak about my experience with our school lunches. Our school lunches let you have a choice of school lunch or salad. On Monday, I had a salad instead of school lunch, and it's nice that we have a choice. My friends and I encourage each other to try salads and veggies. My friend Lily and I were just talking about how good the strawberry chicken salad with poppy seed dressing is. There are salad toppings that you can have, like different ones. Okay, many different choices. We get to meet farmers who grow our food, and we get to try something that we've never tried. We have opportunities to try unique foods. I love edamame now, and our school is serving it this week. There's a lot of fruit and veggies, and we get to have as much as we want. The food I get really needs to be healthy because I have advanced math class in the afternoon, and that requires a lot of concentration. Then I have hockey after school. The food helps me get through the day.
Thank you very much. So, Grace, from 1 to 10, how would you rate your meals, from 10 being the best?
Probably like an 8 or 9.
Oh, that's good. Very good. Thank you. Representative Myra.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bernardi, I want to thank you for bringing forward this this bill, and my question was answered by your great testifiers, but I did want to point out, Mr. Chair, that in the handout, the even-numbered pages are missing, and I was wondering if we could be supplied with that information.
Yes, thank you. Yes,
you, thank you.
Will be. Yes, thank you. Representative Selzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first of all, I just have to welcome Grace and Michelle and Peter to the Capitol. Glen Lake Elementary School is 3 blocks from my home. It's where my children went to school. So welcome. It's wonderful to see you here. And I'm also very happy, Representative Bernardi, to see you bring this bill forward. I also am a member of that bipartisan caucus that's working to reduce childhood obesity. So this is very important. I do have 2 questions. First, I just want to comment that it made me sad to hear that our school districts are supplementing their food budgets by ever-increasing reliance on a la carte items, because that just makes the gap between those who can afford that and those who cannot. And Hopkins has 20%, 28% of the kids on free lunch that cannot afford those a la carte options. So My two questions are, number one, where did the 2 cents come from, and is that enough, because fruits and vegetables cost a lot more than starch? And then number two, I'm wondering, Representative Bernardi, how do you view this, this bill? I was very excited about the bill that Representative Newton brought forward, and do you view that as being in tandem with, which is how I see it, or as replacing it, or just the juxtaposition of those two?
Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Seltzer. Those are very good questions. The 2 cents, I think, was the political reality of what we possibly could get. It hasn't been raised for 6 years. It would be nice to get more, so this committee wants to be more generous. I think it will help students in the long run and help our schools, because basically it becomes a cross-subsidy or reliance on the a la carte. And the a la carte, one thing to mention is people who can afford it, even if they can't afford it, that's not a good thing, because it adds more calories and they're usually not the nutritious food. So that's the other dilemma. Sometimes, you know, healthiness, you know, we want to keep those out of our schools as much as possible. And then I see them in tandem. I think that if we can address both, it's very important for our students and closing the achievement gap.
Thank you, Representative Bernardi. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah,
thank you so much. Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify for or against House File 448? Seeing none, Representative Bernardi, any closing words?
Well, just that I think it's fun to be able to work together here at the Capitol to help create better access for healthy foods for our students and raise the achievement level and in the long run help our children be able to live long, productive lives. And we haven't really mentioned this, but we're responsible for a lot of health care costs in the state, and this is one preventive tool in the toolbox to help our state be healthy and productive. And have a great workforce. I should have said that. I know you like to hear that. Thank you so much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Representative Bernardi. Renews her motion to lay over House File 448 for possible inclusion into the omnibus report. Thank you. We're going to move to House File 973. Representative Dabney, would you like to move your bill?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move, I'd like the strawberries that were just here, but I would like to move House File 973 be before the committee for possible inclusion in the omnibus report.
Very much. Very good. Please proceed.
I think I lost the... Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, 20 years ago, 4% of Minnesota's teachers were teachers of color. In that time, the student population of Minnesota across the state, in the urban core, the suburbs, and throughout greater Minnesota has changed dramatically. 25% of the student body in Minnesota are students of color. Today, 4% of Minnesota teachers are teachers of color. Clearly, we need to attend to this as part of our efforts in this committee to close the achievement gap, providing students with role models, providing other teachers with cultural ambassadors, as it were, is a tested strategy for closing the achievement gap. We do, however, have an excellent program that has existed since 1997 to build on, and that's the Collaborative Urban Educator Program at 3 of the private colleges and universities here in St. Paul. House File, as I find my bill number again, 973, sorry about that, increases the funding and reinvigorates the funding of that program. It also adds a fourth college, Augsburg in Minneapolis, to that program because of the strengths of Augsburg and its existing relationships with the Somali community, as well as the fact that it has a strong campus in Rochester that then works with school districts in the southeastern part of the state. Again, complementing some of the existing outreach efforts that the existing Q programs have to greater Minnesota. Perhaps, Mr. Chair, I don't know what your preferences are, but perhaps Mr. Doug Hennis from St. Thomas would be a good place to start, and then to represent the existing Q programs, and then possibly Mr. Mohammed Mahmoud from the Somali American Parents Association to start the discussion of the focus on adding the Augsburg East African program.
That'd make sense. Very good. Whatever
thank you, Mr.
the
Chair.
Author would like.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt, and members of the committee. My name is Doug Hennis. I'm Vice President for University and Government Relations at St. Thomas. Let me give you a little bit of background on the three programs that have existed dealing with the issues that Representative Dabney identified. St. Thomas, Hamline, and Concordia St. Paul have programs that recruit, educate, and train teachers of color. The St. Thomas program has existed since 1991, Hamline since 1996, and Concordia since 1998. The three schools have collaborated as a consortium since 2001 because our programs really do complement each other and work together rather well. St. Thomas and Hamline were first funded by the legislature to expand our programs in 1997, and Concordia the following year. The three programs, Concordia's is a bachelor's program and licensure program targeted towards Southeast Asian students. They've had 125 graduates since 1998, and they have 20 students enrolled in their program today. St. Thomas's program is a post-baccalaureate licensure program. In recent years, it's specialized in special education. We have 366 graduates, 75% of whom are still involved in education today. And we have 22 students in a special education cohort right now. And the Hamline program has had over 275 bachelor's graduates. Plus, it works has worked with 25,000 teachers in Minnesota schools to help them and train them to better work with in urban and urban-like settings. The in terms of our funding in recent biennia, the three programs have received a total of nearly $1.1 million, and we are in the governor's budget for this next biennium, and we've also met with the State Education Commissioner, who has, signed off on what we're doing. The bill before you, as Representative Dabney indicated, would increase the funding for the programs and at Augsburg as well to a total of about $2 million. So each would receive, the other three programs would receive a bump. St. Thomas, Concordia, and Hamline have met with Augsburg. We believe its program would fit well with ours, would be complementary. There would be very little overlap. And we're supportive of the effort, the Augsburg effort, as long as would not negatively affect our funding, which has been flat for about a decade. So we try to do a little more with a little less every year when you factor in inflation and the like, but we think what Augsburg proposes is good. So generally, we would encourage your support for House File 973, and I'd be happy to answer questions later. And I also have a handout here on our three programs.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to introduce Mr. Mohammed Mahmoud. He's the Executive Director of the Minnesota Somali American Parents Association. Long-time educator.
Very good. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Members of Congress, good morning. Somalia is at the equator, so you can imagine the excess heat over there. And here, and you know, you will not imagine, but you know, the excess cold temperature is there. So, don't ask me why you came here. These immigrants, when we got the analysis, the data analysis of the primary immigrants to Minnesota, to this great state, and the secondary immigrants. The secondary immigrants are much more larger than the primary immigrants. So wherever they are, some of them were given an opportunity to go to Texas, Arizona, California, which close to their climate. But they come to Minnesota. Don't ask me again. So what happened is that great people who came here for the great Minnesota is all the time in need to be a better citizens. They are trying very much If you go around, you can find the you know, what they are doing now, the entrepreneurs, the business, and the young folks out there. So at the beginning of 1992, we came with quite a number of teachers who has been long educators, but all of them has been retired. I'm one of it. So well, the gap starts from there. So we need today teachers who can understand the need of the parents, who can understand the students and can be a role model for them. One of the things that have happened is the last incident in South High. One of the young, she was 16 years old. She said in the press, she said, "I need somebody to understand my feelings." That's exactly what she said. One day, I was transferred to the Department of ELL, their office, so they called, one of the suburbans called me, say that we need help. I went to the office, and I asked the principal, "What's the problem?" And they said, "We have a young lady who is very aggressive, who doesn't talk, but try to fight each one of the students that they go to the class." Then I said, "Show me." I went to the student, and when she came, she cried because I talked to her so much. When she cried, the principal asked me why she is crying, and I said, "Why are you crying?" She said, "I know somebody who can understand me today. I have that person." So I said, asked her, "Why you fight?" And she said, "Well, the people are insulting me, a language I don't understand." So we have a great number of students which we have which has been graduated from the high school, from the colleges, from the universities. But there is a big number who cannot read and write and need a role model. Thank you very much.
And joining me also today is Dr. Janine Gregoire, who's chair of the education department at Augsburg College.
Very good. Dr. Gregoire, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee for asking me to testify today for additional funding for the Augsburg College to be added to Q legislative funding proposal House File 973. Augsburg College has had a strong focus on recruiting and mentoring undergraduate students of color to the college and providing K-12 educational and community outreach to our Cedar Riverside neighborhood and to Minneapolis. We were pleased to be asked by Representative Dabney and our local East African community to further the advancement and preparation of East African teacher candidates at Augsburg College. Such an effort extends the current reach of Q-funded programs in a number of ways. First, as Mr. Mohammed had just previously said, it really increases the number of teacher leaders in the East African community, students that are currently in the pipeline in community centers and many that are already in our freshman and sophomore classes to become teachers and become elementary, secondary, special ed, and ESL teachers and going back to their community. Second, I think this focus on recruiting, preparing, and supporting first-generation East African students, primarily at the undergraduate level, with strong content preparation, ongoing K-12 service to the community, and then leadership development so that they can go back to their community is a really significant thing for us to be able to do. And then finally, Augsburg teacher licensure programs in both Minneapolis and Rochester will enable East African students from our own Cedar Riverside neighborhood and South Central Minnesota, primarily the communities of Rochester, Owatonna, and Faribault, to complete their licensure program and teach within their own home communities. The Augsburg East, or East African Teacher Student-to-Teacher program, builds on existing college-community relationships and creates specific program elements that meet the unique cultural and educational needs of East African teacher leaders. The Augsburg East program has four distinct phases. I've had a handout, I hope that you have received, that kind of outlines those four areas. There's a pre-college undergraduate recruitment and preparation. There's early education experiences and mentoring as freshman and sophomore. There's the third phase, which is building deeper connections to teaching and the communities as juniors and seniors. And then the fourth phase is the career launching and giving back to the community. Each phase builds upon and enhances an existing service at the college to create clear pathways for East African students to move from high school through their undergraduate preparation, their teacher licensure, and ultimately back in service to their community. Greater details of these four phases are on the handout that you've received or are receiving right now. Scholarship funding from the Q would enable more teachers from the East African community to access high-quality teacher education within the metro and south central areas of Minnesota and maintain support for them as they progress through their licensure program and into the field. I would be happy to answer any other questions that you have about this program. Thank you very much.
Very good. Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Dabney, for pointing out the deficiency that we have with regard to representation of educators and minority classes. My question is, obviously the increased funding is to increase the opportunities and perhaps double the number of graduates from 15 to 30 or something of that nature. But what at $35,000 per student, what is different or what can be done in terms of the traditional avenues in which teachers gain their licensure? You know, what sets this apart? What, you know, could these funds be directed, and I'm assuming it's perhaps merged with your existing program already, but what is so uniquely different in terms of getting people of minority to want to be teachers?
Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to ask Mr. Hennis to handle that. Dr. Gregoire may also want to touch on the intensive work that Augsburg already does with its East African student population, but this is hand-to-hand work very intensely with teacher candidates in the existing programs and what Augsburg contemplates there. So maybe Mr. Hennis could speak to that.
Mr. Hennis.
Representative Hertens and committee members. I can speak from experience with the St. Thomas program, which has existed now for 22 years. We established it in our School of Education and have a full-time administrator who goes out and recruits and really beats the bushes looking for people. Our program, for the most part, is what we would call a second career program. It's people who've decided, you know, that they want to do something different. Our most successful alumnus, or probably best known alumnus, is Bernadia Johnson, who's superintendent of Minneapolis Public Schools. She had been laid off from a job in the private sector, had done some volunteer work in a children's school, decided she wanted to go back to school, and you can see where she is today. Through people like her and other alums, this network is really created, and the word gets out that our program, Hamlin's, Concordia's, and now Augsburg's, are good places to go to get the kind of education and training that they need. And then our programs also provide a lot of follow-up support as well. So I think that network that we've been able to create for more than two decades now has really paid off. One of the best numbers, I think, as I mentioned earlier, 75% of our nearly 400 alums still are in education today. Two out of three of those 400 are still in education in Minnesota, whether they're teachers or administrators. So something with the program has worked. You know, they made a decision to change careers, they got into the classroom, and they decided to remain in education.
Is there anyone here in the audience that would like to testify for or against House File 973? Seeing none, Representative Dabney, any closing thoughts?
Mr. Chair, this is an opportunity for us to grow our own and to reach into today's classrooms and recruit and advance and train the teachers of tomorrow that will look more like the classrooms of today and tomorrow. And I would, the private sector actively recruits diversity because they see it as a strength in their workforce. I see it as a strength in our teacher corps and would urge support for the bill. Thank you very much.
And Representative Dabney renews his motion to lay over House File 973 for possible inclusion into the omnibus report. Thank you very much. Members, thank you. We are adjourned.